Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA. It is my distinct pleasure as we link with Her Excellency, Ambassador Anne Anderson, who is the voice of Ireland, the representative of Ireland, the Irish government in the United States. And Ambassador, you're very welcome to the program.
Thank you, Adrian, and it's my great pleasure to be here and chatting with you and through you to your audience. And before we go any further, Adrian, just one thing. We haven't spoken on air, even if we've spoken in person, since you got your honorary doctorate from Quinnipiac. So let me on air say our congratulations, our co-gorgeous again, to Dr. Adrian Flannery. It was a great achievement, and we were all delighted and happy about it.
Fortunately, when one blushes, it doesn't show on radio. So
well,
I will accept that, and thank you very much. But let me ask you a little bit about yourself first. This is your second major assignment in the United States. Not bad for a Clonmel, County Tipperary girl who received a Bachelor of Arts degree in History and Politics from University College in Dublin, and actually entered the Department of Foreign Affairs in 1972. Can you bring us to that decision and to that year, and what prompted you to join the Department of Foreign Affairs in the first place?
Well, I was 20 years old in 1972. I had emerged, as you said, from college with a degree in history and political science. I would like to be able to tell you that I had wanted to be a diplomat since I was knee-high, but it really wasn't like that. I was searching around for something that would be worthwhile. I wanted something that was in the public service. I always felt that was tremendously worthwhile. I thought about perhaps being a teacher, a couple of other social worker, those kind of things appealed to me. And then, as it happened, my father always wanted me to be a civil servant. I was very resistant to the idea of civil service. To me, this was a dreary, paid, pensionable job, and it didn't fit with my self-image. But one day, he, having failed to persuade me to apply for other civil service jobs, he brought my attention to advertisements for this exotic-sounding job called Third Secretary. That was the graduate entry level to the diplomatic service. And I was somewhat intrigued by it, and I thought, well, I'll apply. The process of application will be interesting. My father would be happy. And then I went through, I thought I wouldn't get it anyway, I went through a whole series of interviews and began to be more absorbed and fascinated by the whole idea the further I went in the process. And finally, I got the job, and I thought, well, I'll try this for a couple of years. I never imagined that this would be a decades-long, lifetime commitment to the career. But I, from the moment I went into the job, it was a really exciting time. I went in late 72. We became a member of the European Union on the 1st of January, 73. New horizons were opening up. The Foreign Service was expanding. You had enormous responsibility at a very young age. I was sometimes directly briefing ministers and so on. It was intoxicating, fulfilling, exciting, and I have absolutely fallen in love with my career as the years have gone by.
The job that you had in the United Nations as permanent representative is what it's called, but it's actually Ireland's ambassador to the UN.
Yes.
What the parameters with respect to, you know, how Ireland is perceived by the United Nations, considering that Ireland is, you know, one of the hundreds of countries, many of them not even represented by the United Nations. But can you paint a picture for us? What's that atmosphere like?
Well, I've had a long time commitment to the United Nations. I was the political part of the UN, as you know, is in New York. A lot of the humanitarian, human rights, development work is done in Geneva, and there's a major UN office there. I had been 6 years ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva from 1995 to 2001. So I was quite steeped in UN work before I came to New York and, as you said, was 4 years ambassador to the UN there from 2009 to 2013. I would say, and I'm really being honest here, Adrian, not trying to present everything through rose-colored spectacles, but I would honestly say that Ireland has an extraordinarily high reputation at the United Nations. And that's borne out objectively any time we're a candidate for membership of major UN bodies, the Security Council or the Human Rights Council. We have an immensely successful track record of running for election, which means we have the esteem and the support of our peers. It's based on really decades of hard work by generations of Irish diplomats at the UN since we joined in 1955, and also the commitment, of course, that exists back in Ireland and by the Irish people. We are the only country that continuously, since our membership began in 1955, have always served in UN peacekeeping. Throughout all the decades, we've always had people out there, our military, serving as highly respected UN peacekeepers in different parts of the world. We have a strong human rights record there. Of course, Mary Robinson did a great job as High Commissioner for Human Rights. During my own time in Geneva, I chaired the Human Rights Commission. For a year, it was Mary Robinson and myself on the podium, dual stereophonic voices of Ireland, myself as ambassador and Mary, of course, in the wider role as High Commissioner. We have a very strong development aid record, both in the amounts of development aid, and I would say I was always very proud that during the toughest austerity years that we've been through from 2008 to 2013, we still, not fully, but more or less kept our aid contribution intact, and the quality of our aid is recognised at the United Nations as well. So I know it's a cliche to talk about punching above your weight, but I was, every day at the UN, I was really proud of our record. And let me tell you something that exists on a more human scale, if you like, when you take away all of those statistics and you just look at the human interactions. Again and again, I met ambassadors at the United Nations from African countries, Asian countries, Latin American countries, who talked to me about their experience of being educated in their countries by Irish priests or Irish nuns. And they had tremendously positive recollections of that experience. And they told me stories, not just of the formal education they got, but how Irish priests and nuns became mentors for them, stayed in touch with them, encouraged them. And more than once I've heard from ambassadors, I wouldn't be here were it not for the imprint of the education I had from the Irish priests and nuns. So an awful lot of strands combine to make up our reputation at the UN, but it is a very, very strong reputation.
You might confirm for us something that which I try to mention quite often, and that is that the Irish people are among the most generous in the entire world in aiding, you know, the devastation of third world countries. Maybe some of that has a connection with the missionaries who went into those areas, and even all of us in growing up in Ireland, part of, I'm not sure that it was part of the curriculum, but definitely it was very prominent in Ireland, that contributing even the pennies to the missions and to the missionaries, some of that must have stuck with us in terms of, from our own experience in the Irish famine right through today, that despite economic hardships and downturn and all the rest of it, the Irish come out on top in terms of being massively great contributors regardless.
Well, that's absolutely right, Adrian, and all the figures and statistics show that when you look at per capita private contributions, leaving aside official government contributions to development aid, when you look at contributions from private individuals, we always score way up at the top of the league in terms of the per capita contributions. And I think you're right, too, in the two factors that you've pointed to. There is, of course, the historical memory that is part of the DNA, I think, of everybody in Ireland. When you look back on our own history and the famine and the deprivation, and, you know, often it is a history of heartbreak and suffering. I mean, some very joyful things in our history.
Right.
But there's a lot of heartbreak in our own history, which, of course, gives people that historical memory and the empathy. But I do think as well it was aided by the exposure we had, I mean, in so many towns and villages, in the intimate communities that you have in those towns and villages, people would have known of a son or a daughter of a local family who was on the mission somewhere, often in very exotic places. But the stories would come back home, the letters would be written home. And, you know, we always had in our homes, in our churches, in our schools, the boxes there, as you said, to contribute.
Yeah.
And I think the children were encouraged to do it at a very young age. You know, we all had the pennies, the idea that you'd put your penny in the box.
Right.
And I think the fact that we were exposed to it and we heard local stories about it and we felt connected to it, the influences that form you early on obviously stay with you. And there's no doubt whenever there is an emergency somewhere in the world, you and there's exposure of that on Irish television, you get an outpouring of support and empathy and generosity.
You know, it is said that were it not for the missionaries, the Irish missionaries, that perhaps NGOs that would follow, Concern, Goal, so many of them that are Irish founded, that in fact the work of missionaries continues through Irish volunteers, through those who you know, have this great ability to simply pitch in and to devote their entire lives to continue the work of the missionaries. We're on top there as well.
Yeah, I mean, the inspiration and the ethos is the same. They, as you know, vocations have fallen off greatly in Ireland as everywhere else. So there are much fewer numbers now doing it as priests or as nuns. But the as I said, the inspiration and the ethos that motivates young and not so young people to do it is just as admirable. And I've met so many of these people throughout my career. We all do, but obviously in my job working on human rights and developments and humanitarian issues, it brought me into contact with very many of those kind of people from Ireland and from elsewhere around the world, but of course particularly from Ireland. And again and again and again, I have been struck by the work they do, the unending commitment and dedication. And, you know, I often thought, here we are working very hard in places like Geneva and New York, but
right.
in the comfort of civilized cities like Geneva and New York, and the admiration I have for the people who are out there toiling in extraordinarily challenging conditions of deprivation and climatic conditions and so on.
Yeah,
they're the real heroes,
yes.
And I've always, always understood that.
Ambassador, also, we should point out that many of those, you mentioned the comfort of Geneva and New York and Western civilization, but many of those literally put their lives at risk. Wherever there is strife, whether that is natural disasters or war in any of those areas. These are people who are prepared to leave at a moment's notice actually go into those areas without any guarantee whatsoever of their safety. Their reputation is such that they're generally considered to be neutral, and that their recognition is for humanitarian work. But that doesn't take anything away from the fact that these are people who are going into a place already devastated. And to that end, I think it just kind of, it does show, again, the spirit of the Irish and the recognition that we too come from, areas of uncertainty, the devastation, again, of the famine, that all of that together should give us the image and the positive image that we have throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely correct. I mean, when you think about, for example, the Irish peacekeepers who are serving as blue helmets at the United Nations, and the reputation they have, and they go into, obviously, if they're there, if there's a United Nations peacekeeping force there, it's because it's a difficult and fragile and brittle situation. But time and again, it's the Irish peacekeepers are in demand. Everybody wants the Irish peacekeepers because of the reputation they have, both for professionalism and empathy with the local communities. And the others in the, you know, the goals and the concerns and the people working in the NGOs like that, they too do that work that is so, so valuable and so difficult and often so dangerous, because we all know in the kind of world we're living in now, war is more fragmented, the threats to peace are not the conventional classical threats, and that makes civilians more vulnerable, and that's something that is of huge concern in the United Nations and in the NGO community, because if you look at the graph of fatalities and risk and so on, mm-hmm. you find that civilians are more and more exposed to risk now when they're doing that kind of humanitarian work abroad. So it's a noble dedication of their lives, and one for which we must have great respect and admiration.
And it would be unfair not to recognize the successive governments in Ireland in terms of being there, having the backs of those, who choose to, God knows it's not for the money, because that also, these are, I think, the secular follow-up, of the missionaries. So, to that end, I think that the governments of Ireland, with zero exceptions, have been very supportive and continue to be.
Yeah, and you see it again in a slightly different way. But, for example, we've all witnessed the terrible scenes in the, death and devastation in the Mediterranean with refugees fleeing from Syria and so on to mainland Europe, and all the undoubted problems that comes with that. But the Irish government, we're not part of the so-called Schengen arrangement. This is the free movement of peoples within the European Union for complex reasons, because Britain stayed out, and because of free movement with Britain, we stayed out. So, in short, we didn't have legal obligations when the division was taking place of the European commitment, when country after country was being told this is your quota, so to speak. Legally, we had no quota. Right. But the Irish government in the last couple of years stepped forward very quickly and said we will actually take an allocation of 4,000, which is more than the quota that would have been given to us had we been a member of Schengen and therefore had a legal obligation. So again, and the government did that because they knew there was the support of people in Ireland for making that commitment. So the government was stepping up to the plate and taking on a responsibility that was more than any legal responsibility it would have had. So, you know, we're not, I'm not, clearly, neither you nor I, Adrian, would suggest that Ireland is, you know, sort of some kind of wonderful country where every individual is a saint or a scholar, and that we're all perfect. We're not. We're flawed human beings like everybody else. But there is a tremendous amount to be proud of, in the dedication and the generosity and the open-heartedness of Irish people that has been demonstrated again and again in all parts of the world.
The spectacular festival Ireland 100, celebrating a century of Irish arts and culture, took, number one, it took 2 years, and again, this was an initiative of the Irish government to indeed reach out and become partners with Irish communities throughout the world, but in particular, I think that the success of the centenary celebration commemoration is something that is has been and is second to none. It was the total display of the great friendship and love of Ireland, Irish America, and indeed Americans in general, many of whom had little or no recognition of the significance of the centenary.
It's been a tremendous year in the United States, Adrian, as you said, really beyond all our expectations. We knew from the beginning of the planning of the centenary that we wanted something very significant and on a really big scale to happen here in the United States. Because I think most of your listeners may well be aware of this, but it's something that I keep reminding people of. The five of the seven signatories of the Proclamation of 1916 had spent significant periods in the United States, were very influenced by their time spent here. The United States is the only foreign country that is specifically mentioned in the proclamation, that call to our exiled children in America. And of course, we know the attachment of Irish Americans to the ancestral homeland. We know the numbers. There are over 35 million here of Irish ancestry, at least that's what the census tells us. Yeah. There are probably many more beyond that. So for all those reasons, we really wanted the celebrations to be very significant and meaningful here. And there was a great partnership between the government, between the embassy and the consulates, and between the Irish community organizations. So it came from the grassroots. It was something that we in the diplomatic service worked on. There was huge support back in Ireland. And the results really have been spectacular. There have been over, we are still counting, but we will be well over 300 events that will have taken place throughout the United States. Some very large scale events, some more modest, but of tremendous variety, cultural and celebratory and seminars and films and documentaries and
yes.
A tremendous outpouring of interest and enthusiasm and support.
You know, which again, rather than a series of events, some large, some small, as you pointed out, this will have an ongoing recognition and effect for all the areas, again, that you have mentioned. This was not just something which disappears like a one-day concert, a festival. This has legs, and I think all in all, even begrudgers would have to say that this was a very, very special commemoration and celebration of 100 years, despite those who on both sides of the Atlantic had a reluctance, saying, this is not a good time, the fragile situation in Northern Ireland, this is going to stir the pot, so to speak. None of that, thankfully, whereas there was some, and there are some, very good organizations that would have liked to, you know, to read more into this and to actually act accordingly. But all in all, this became exactly what it was intended to be. And that is, you know, again, the commemoration and celebration of a very significant part of our history.
Well, I'm delighted that you perceived it that way, Adrian, and I think that would be the broad perception of it. And I, there was a great deal in planning, not just of the events, but of the tone and the whole feel of these celebrations, because it could have been divisive, but it was very, very clear to all of us, to the government, the people back at home, us in the diplomatic service, that we wanted to present this in a very positive way. And the themes that ran through it were themes like reconcile and reimagine. And of course, we wanted to be true to the historical event of 1916, and to examine that with truth and objectivity and give honour where it was due, all of that. But at the same time, we wanted it to be something more dynamic, not just a contemplation of an event of 100 years ago, but to celebrate the 100-year journey. To look at how we have fared as a nation through those 100 years, and to look at the successes, all the reasons we have to feel proud, but at the same time to look through a clear lens and where there are areas where we have fallen short, to acknowledge that too. And as much as anything, as you said, in the legacy of this, the whole idea was to look at the origins in 1916, the 100-year journey, but also to set our compass for the period ahead. And in the light of that pride and celebration, but also an examination of our record to see where we could do better, to find ourselves in 2016 with a new sense of purpose, a real revitalization, both as a nation, also in our emigrant communities, and renewing our sense of purpose and commitment. So I think it has achieved those objectives, and that as we look back on it, and we'll be doing a lot of reflection on this as we end the year, what we can build on, how we, you know, of course we can't have a centenary celebration on this scale every year, mm-hmm. but they're looking at the essence of it all, the pride, the common effort, the identification of the global community with what was going on back at home, the re-examination of the ideals of 1916 and see how we can continue to match up to those ideals. I really want to help lead a reflection here in the United States in the latter part of this year as to how we build on this and have a living legacy from all the wonderful events of this year.
In New York, where, again, many of the leaders of the 1916 rebellion worked closely with and got their message across to the United States by their seminars and their meetings and all of the other very positive aspects, which again would cement forever and a day the great friendship and support of the Irish in America. And again, I have to be careful, because I think when we say the Irish in America, we might be giving short shrift to Americans who themselves, beyond the Irish, were able to relate to and support and continue to do that. The series of events that continue, again, are a great tribute. But let me ask you in particular about the spectacular festival, Ireland 100, that again, it was a collaboration between the embassy, your Ballywick there, and the John F. Kennedy Center, which in fact ran for 3 weeks from May 17th, you know, beginning on May 17th. An amazing feat, and one that brings, you know, the real Irish connection to the Kennedy Center and Washington, D.C. Can you give us an overview of what that actually meant and what that will mean as we go forward?
Right, I'll try to capture the whole scale of the thing in a few sentences. It really was extraordinary. As you said, over 3 weeks in the Kennedy Center, which is possibly the most prestigious art center in the United States, and very much the national center. We wanted something in the nation's capital to accompany everything that was happening around the United States. And of course, the specific linkage with the Kennedy family had a very important resonance for us as well. So for all those reasons, we wanted it at the Kennedy Center, and we wanted it on a scale that matched the significance of the occasion. I think we achieved that. The Kennedy Center, as you probably know, it has multiple venues, theatres of different size and stages of different size. So on any given day, there were things happening all over the center. We ended up with, over the 3 weeks, more than 150 performances by more than 600 artists. And we had about, we're still getting the exact statistics from the Kennedy Center, but we know that there were some 35,000 people who attended those various performances. Yeah. And to take up that point, I mean, a lot of the people who come to the Kennedy Center are, of course, who came to these performances because of the Irish connection, but so many of the people who came were Americans who were intrigued and interested, related to Irish culture, of course, but also to the whole ideals of freedom and independence and self-determination that are common themes in their own history and the history of 1916. So very diverse audiences and capacity audiences for most of the performances. We had all of the leading performers from Ireland, but we ensured that there was good representation from Irish-American artists as well to really make it a joint thing. But we had theatre, we had the Abbey, of course, Do the Plough and the Stars. We had Fishamble Theatre. We had an extraordinary literary program. We had music. We had camerata. We had the gloaming. We had dance. And I loved that we very deliberately crafted it this way with the Kennedy Center. We tried to, I mean, they were the final arbiters of who would appear, but they were very collaborative in their approach and we worked very closely with them. And we wanted the best that of traditional and classical arts in Ireland, but we wanted to mix it up with a lot that was contemporary and cutting edge in Irish culture as well, so that people could see the full spectrum, all that they identified with, but a lot that was new as well. And the overall, the huge audience interest, very good reviews, and a lot of the artists that came will be invited back, and the Kennedy Center were impressed with them, and they have got to connect with different audiences. So it was a tremendously joyful outpouring of Irish talent and Irish celebration over the 3 weeks. Opened, as you may remember, on the first night, we had this gala performance, and the Taoiseach came over for it. Vice President Biden was there. We had a stellar audience, and you know, lots of people like Chief Justice Roberts was there, and various other luminaries, members of the Kennedy family, of course. And a wonderful opening night, which set the tone. And then 3 weeks of indoors and outdoors. We had outdoor stages as well, continual performance of Irish dance, and we had a red-headed day, and we had wonderful art installations in the main halls of the Kennedy Center as well. Huge earth harp, Owen stones, reproduction Owen stones that were very, very beautiful, and that made a great statement in one of the entrance halls. So it was just an outpouring of Irish talent and a a tremendously joyful 3 weeks and very, very successful.
And the marking the significance of the centenary of the Easter Rising did not get lost in all of that, which is, again, a great tribute. That was the reason for the commemorations and celebrations.
Yes, and that was captured, even as you said, the title of it all was Ireland 100, which of course was immediately meaningful to many Irish Americans because they understood about the centenary. But for the wider audiences, even the very title intrigued them, and of course they came and they got to know more, and we organised all sorts of events around it as well. And for example, if people are interested in going to the embassy website, you'll see a discussion that I led towards the end of the festival, where we brought in people like Fiona Shaw and Colin
sure.
McCann and Paula Meehan, and had a great discussion in the embassy about the significance of all of this and how it related to the centenary and issues in current Ireland and so on. So we tried to make sure that, yes, it was all about a cultural celebration, but people understood the context and the significance, and that there were opportunities for a discussion of the historical and contemporary issues that are relevant.
Yes. There are two events that I would like to address. One is on Sunday, April 24th, here in New York City, the New York commemoration of the Easter Rising at Wagner Park and Pirae in Battery Park City, to over 5,000 people to that ceremony by the Government of Ireland and the Irish community, including, of course, the reading of the proclamation of the Irish Republic. We do want to pay tribute to, of course, our own Consul General of Ireland here in New York, Barbara Jones, and a huge team who singularly, put on the greatest sense of unity, incorporating every branch of the Irish community into a singular day that will never be forgotten. It was something of tremendous significance, and it went without a hitch.
I was there, Adrian,
and
I echo everything you said. It is tremendous praise due to the Consul General, Barbara Jones, the consulate team, but also the wider community who came in behind that. And, of course, as you know, for all of the New York celebrations, Professor Maureen Murphy led the committee, the Greater New York Commemorative Committee, who did extraordinary planning for that. But that weekend was absolutely spectacular. I remember vividly, we'll always remember that Sunday, and with the beautiful blue sky, the Statue of Liberty in the background, the reading of the proclamation by the same army member who had read the proclamation in Dublin on Easter Sunday this year, and the music and the concert and the sense of the community coming together with such pride. It was absolutely marvellous. And of course, the preceding day then, the Saturday, the AOH had organised the Mass in St. Patrick's Cathedral, and the parade and the speeches afterwards. Another
huge,
great day.
Massive crowd. Again, the largest singular event hosted by the Ancient Order of Hibernians in America. Something, again, that won't be forgotten anytime soon. It showed, again, that the cohesiveness of an Irish-American community is indeed intact and very much a part of indeed the centenary celebrations and commemorations.
If I might interrupt you there, Adrian, I think that's going to be a great legacy from the commemorations this year, that sense of cohesiveness of the community. Because, you know, there's no question on some issues. There are nuances of difference in perspectives and views and so on. That's absolutely normal in a community as large as ours. But the great collaboration, the coming together, in certainly in the embassy, and I know in the consulate in New York and in various other consulates as well, there was joint planning about all of this. All the organizations were so happy to sit around the table, talk to each other about the joint planning, work together on joint events. We had another great event down here in D.C., the renovation of the statue of Robert Emmet. And again, that was an event that was co-organized by the AOH and the Irish American Unity Conference and ourselves and other organizations. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, we really got to experience what it was like to work together with shared objectives, serving a common cause, and to experience the satisfaction, indeed even the exhilaration, of being able to bring off these big events when we all put our shoulder to the wheel together. So I think we all learned something from it, and that cohesiveness, I hope, will be something that we can sustain as we go forward.
On Robert Emmet before we move on from that, you know, there were... whereas obviously the centenary, the focus was on 1916, but Robert Emmet, again, and his connection to New York and his visit to New York, all of which, when Porrick Pierce, indeed in particular, he venerated Robert Emmet and admired him in many of the speeches that he made in New York at the time.
Absolutely. And I think people, some of your listeners around the country, will probably have experienced that in their own parts of the States as well. Some of the events that were at the heart of these celebrations, they had a link to 1916, but maybe, you know, went in slightly different directions, and we were able to celebrate those links. As you said, Robert Emmet was a great source of inspiration for the 1916 leaders, and Pierce in particular. And his statue had been installed here in the park in D.C. To coincide with the 50th anniversary of 1916. But we felt that there was a joint project with the organizations I mentioned and with the National Park Service and the Smithsonian Institute. We really needed to do a lot of work to make that little park area look better and to set up placards that would explain to passers-by. So we did a whole renovation of it to coincide with the 100th anniversary. So I think projects like that happened right around the country. And, you know, so it was a very... broad definition of what it was we were commemorating and celebrating. And that was great. That gave diversity and breadth to the whole celebration and led, as I said, to some great collaborations.
Can we go to Ireland? I know that we have devoted a lot of time to Irish America and to the great commemorations and celebrations. But can we go to Ireland and ask you about the aftermath of the surprise British referendum, which indeed the which will without doubt lead to the exit of Britain from the European Union, and how does that affect the island of Ireland?
Well, there is a great deal of concern, as you well know, and your listeners will know, Adrian, about the outcome of the British referendum on the 23rd of June. We had been quite outspoken in advance of that referendum, campaigning for a vote to stay in the European Union. We felt that leaving would be bad for Britain, but that's up to them to judge. But that was our view. Bad for the European Union, and certainly not good for the island of Ireland. also there has been a great deal of concern. In terms of the island of Ireland, there are two dimensions, or two principal dimensions, obviously an enormously complicated issue, and it's going to be a tough and probably quite messy negotiation over the next 2 years or more as Britain extricates itself from the European Union. For us, obviously, the two major issues are the position of Northern Ireland and the All-Ireland relationship, and the economic consequences for Ireland. The Taoiseach has already met with the new British Prime Minister to discuss the North-South dimension, and there is a determination on both sides that we will not see a hardening, if you want to describe it that way, of the border between the two parts of the island. The idea that now there would be an external border of the European Union cutting across the two parts of our island contains huge risks and potential consequences. So there is an absolute determination on the part of both governments to work together to ensure that we don't see a hardening of that border, that the flow of people and goods and so on across that border remains as it is, and as we have worked to make it become over recent years. Of course, the border exists. The border is there legally. It hasn't in any way faded away. But on a de facto basis, people living on both sides of the border, they hardly notice its existence as they go about their daily lives and their work and their interactions across the border. We want to keep things that way. We want to absolutely keep the easy fluidity of travel and all of that. We want to make sure that the Good Friday Agreement continues to be the agreement that governs the relationships between both parts of the island. So we have already started a serious campaign in Dublin, a campaign of outreach to the key European leaders. The Taoiseach has been to Berlin to see Mrs. Merkel. President Hollande of France has been in Ireland. And every occasion is already being seized to explain the sensitivity of this issue, to explain the imperatives, and to ensure that there is not just the determination of the British and Irish governments, but that there is the support and the buy-in of the other European leaders for the best possible outcome in relation to the North-South dimension.
Yes.
So there's that. The other aspect is the the economic aspect. Over the years, we have worked to diversify our markets for our trade and our exports. So there is now much less dependence on the British market than there would have been a decade or two ago. Nevertheless, it's still very significant. 16% of our exports go to the United Kingdom. And that's an important 16% because it's largely its agricultural exports, and it's the exports of small and medium-sized firms in Ireland who are the indigenous Irish firms, not the big multinationals who can seek markets all over the world, but the somewhat more vulnerable smaller Irish indigenous firms. So again, we will be doing everything we can to ensure that when Britain leaves, the relationship between Britain and the European Union remains as positive and constructive as possible. Obviously, we would like to see the free market of goods continuing. That would make it much simpler for us to continue our trading relationship. But it's a highly complicated negotiation. Depends on what Britain wants, what Britain tries to insist on, and the overall bargain that is struck between Europe and Britain. But we have big issues at stake here, and it's going to be an enormous diplomatic challenge for us over the period ahead. But we're very determined to get the best possible outcome.
The notion that Ireland, in fact, might seriously look at the benefits following the British exit from the European Union. That again, a red herring. 86% of those polled in Ireland, which is a phenomenal poll, says Ireland will stay in the EU regardless. And
oh, there's no question about that. It's an ironclad determination. There's no ambiguity about that. As you said, the poll that took place in the early aftermath of the British referendum, well, the figures spoke for themselves. As you said, 86% felt Ireland's place continued to be in the European Union. Only 9% of the population felt that we should follow Britain out of the European Union. So we will unquestionably be remaining at the heart of Europe. We will be working for the most constructive possible relationship between a Britain outside the European Union and the Union. And we will be working, I mean, we'll be doing everything we can to yes. mitigate and reduce those potential downsides that I've spoken about. And of course, we'll be looking at any potential benefits for us. I mean, we didn't want this to happen. We campaigned against it. But no question, there will be a certain movement, particularly in the financial sector and so on, from yes. Firms that are now concentrated and have thousands of people in London. And some of the big banks and the financial institutions and some other companies will be looking to move at least some of those clusters of people working in London to other parts of the European Union. And they'll be looking at cities like Dublin and Frankfurt and Paris sure. and so on. So, of course, I mean, there's nothing crassly opportunistic about our approach, but we would be very foolish if we stayed behind the door. We will be out there, you know, of course, trying to, in a situation that we didn't want, but now that we have to deal with, and we have to deal with the downsides, but of course we will be seeing what potential benefits there are for the Irish economy, and we will be putting our case forward for people who will be taking that decision to move at least some of their personnel into locations that are within the European Union.
Absolutely. On the issue, and I think a lot of people were surprised here that the Taoiseach of Ireland, Enda Kenny, would indeed make reference to a portion of the Good Friday Agreement which calls for the reunification of Ireland. Many felt that might have been premature in the sense that there are a lot of eggs to be fried in one pan at the moment, and in fact that the poll for Northern Ireland might indeed just add fuel to the fire at this point, particularly since polls would indicate that even if there was a poll in Northern Ireland, it would not bring the desired result for the nationalist community.
I think there is clarity about that point, that, and there is an understanding that a poll at this time would be divisive, and all of the indications would suggest that if such a poll were held today, that you would not get a majority voting in the north in favour of reunification of the island. I think what the Taoiseach was doing was wanting to draw attention to that provision that exists in the Good Friday Agreement. It's important that we're all mindful that that provision for such a poll in certain circumstances does exist, and that as we go forward and things continue to evolve into the future, that everybody continues in the future to be mindful of that provision of the Good Friday Agreement, because it was an important provision of the Good Friday Agreement, and certainly it's not something that needs to be that can be ever lost to sight. It's something we need to be mindful that it's there in the right circumstances. But given the current state of play and the challenges immediately confronting us over the next months and the couple of years, there isn't any suggestion that we would be trying to have that provision invoked in the immediate or short term.
There is an understanding that
at this time such a poll would be divisive and would not lead to a vote within Northern Ireland in for reunification, at least insofar as all of the evidence available to us currently would suggest. Things, of course, will continue to evolve over time. We will be mindful of all the circumstances. And the Taoiseach was calling attention to that provision in the Good Friday Agreement. And as I said earlier, we want the Good Friday Agreement to remain the agreement that governs the arrangements north, south and between the islands and so on. And we are attached to every provision of that agreement, including the one to which the Taoiseach was referring.
Finally, I would like you to comment on immigration reform, and God knows between as we look at the UK and their major decision to exit the European Union, as we look at Ireland and an election which again brought a new face to the government in Ireland and a broader coalition government, and as we look at our own elections in the United States, I think it would be fair to say that predictions right now with respect to immigration reform and how that affects our community here, the Irish citizens who, through no fault of their own, are living in the shadows here, there are those who say, forget about it, it's not going to happen now, it's not going to happen in the next administration, we've lost the battle. Can you comment on, from an Irish government perspective, as to how this will be revisited and how realistic is it to think that in the next administration, I think those who are saying, you know, next year that will be, you know, on the top 100 of the agenda of a new government in the United States. What is realistic and what is the Irish government prepared to do to help in this situation?
I think we need to keep a careful balance in responding to a question like that, Adrian, because on the one hand, I am deeply conscious of our undocumented who've had their hopes raised repeatedly only to be dashed repeatedly over recent years. And I think there's a kind of emotional cruelty involved here if you overly reassure the undocumented or try to suggest to them that, look, it's a certainty, it's on the horizon, just keep going and it's going to be in the bag, you know, in the coming months or
yes.
And I would never go down that path. I mean, these people have been so disappointed so often that we have to be very, very careful about what we hold out as a likely prospect for the future. On the other hand, I don't succumb to the pessimism of those who would say that, look, it's we might as well forget about it. There's no question I'm deeply frustrated. The effort that we've put into this over years, and certainly over my 3 years here, you know, deeply frustrated. There were times when it looked tantalisingly close and then it disappeared again. But I think the November elections obviously are going to be tremendously important in terms of who's in the White House, what the balance looks like in the two houses of Congress, what's going to happen in the Senate, what's going to happen in the House. But I remain very hopeful that the circumstances will evolve in such a way as to make immigration reform a realistic prospect in the course of 2017, probably the latter part of the year rather than the earlier part of the year. Because I think things are going to be learned irrespective of the outcome of this election. Obviously, you know, I'm a diplomat and I have to remain absolutely bipartisan. But you can see how certain outcomes could give you a cast of characters that would be people who would be in the vanguard of immigration reform. On the other hand, you could see lessons being learned from this election outcome, And the Hispanicization of this country is continuing inexorably. And in terms of, leave aside all of the moral and ethical arguments in favor of immigration reform, there are arguments to be made based simply on the prospects of any political party of securing their future in this country if they continue to alienate the Hispanic community in particular, which is growing in such numbers, if they continue to alienate that community by an absolute refusal to contemplate immigration reform. So I'm not for a minute suggesting we're waiting for others or other communities to get this sorted for us. We in the Irish community, the Irish government, the Irish diplomatic service will remain unrelenting in our efforts to keep this issue on the agenda, to confront American politicians at every level with the imperative to move this forward. But I think, you know, if we're looking at comprehensive immigration reform, we've always understood that we have to be part of a coalition in moving this forward. I think that after the November election, we may get a set of circumstances that will be conducive to finally moving this forward. We have the commitment of the current House Speaker, Paul Ryan. We have good channels to Paul Ryan and so on. But in looking at the other cast of leading personalities and figures in power that will emerge, I remain hopeful. And I think the circumstances could be conducive to it, and I am certain that our own unrelenting efforts will continue to add our voice to try to push this forward. So to finish, I talked about that balance. It's very complex. There are no easy paths forward here. We can't conjure up any magic solutions, and we should be very, very careful in dealing with the hopes and the emotions of our undocumented. But at the same time, the effort will continue and there are grounds for some optimism.
I want to thank you very much you know, for spending the time with us. But as indeed, as the first woman, ambassador from Ireland, to the United States, and indeed we're proud also of our own Consul General Barbara Jones here. But it is a difficult time. It has been a difficult time, but it's not all doom and gloom. And thank you for pointing that out to us today.
Oh, well, it's been such a pleasure, Adrian, to chat with you. It's, as you say, it's been a posting full of challenges. The challenges will continue, but there have also been tremendous satisfactions, moments of great joy, moments of celebration, and every day is a day of pride, really, when I see the Irish imprint in this country. So thank you, Adrian. Great opportunity to talk to your listeners.
Thank you indeed very much. And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.